It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. U.S. seeks negotiated settlement to war in Syria. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States will have to reach an agreement with Syria's President Bashar al-Assad to enable a political transition of power and bring a stop to the five-year-old civil war that's left thousands dead. Secretary Kerry spoke Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation. He did not specify what the terms of any potential agreement with Mr. Assad could include.
We are working very hard with other interested parties to see if we can reignite a diplomatic outcome. Why? Because everybody agrees there is no military solution. There is only a political solution.
With another round of nuclear talks to begin this week between Washington and Tehran, Secretary Kerry says the obstacles to an agreement are largely political rather than technical. Mr. Kerry will meet in Switzerland with Iranian counterpart Mohammad Javad Zarif in the next round of talks on the future of Iran's nuclear program. Three male British teenagers allegedly seeking to join Islamic State extremists in Syria were arrested in London after being deported from Turkey. Scotland Yard police on Sunday did not identify the three suspects, but said they were detained Friday in Istanbul. Turkish media reports the three were arrested after a flight from Barcelona. 10 U.S. aid workers who may have been exposed to the Ebola virus in Sierra Leone are being evacuated to the United States. Officials say the individuals will be housed near the University of Nebraska Medical Center, the National Institutes of Health in Maryland, or Emory University Hospital in Atlanta. A U.S. healthcare worker arrived last Friday at NIH for treatment after dealing with Ebola in Sierra Leone. This is VOA News. Sierra Leone's President Ernest Bai Koroma says Vice President Samuel Sam-Simana should not fear for his life or feel threatened. He went into hiding after his guards were suddenly disarmed and replaced without his knowledge or approval. Samuel Sam-Simana earlier had been expelled from the ruling All People's Congress after being accused of fomenting violence and seeking to establish a new party. He's reported to have asked for asylum in the American embassy. Two suicide bombings outside Christian churches in the eastern city of Lahore Sunday killed at least 15 people and wounded more than 70 others. A militant gang attached to the outlawed Pakistani Taliban is claiming responsibility. Ayaz Ghul reports.
The bombings minutes apart targeted a Catholic and a Protestant church in a majority Christian suburb, Yuhanabad, where thousands of people had gathered for Sunday services. Hospital officials say many of those wounded in the attack are in critical condition. A senior Lahore police officer, Heather Ashraf, says two gunmen wearing suicide vests tried to shoot their way into the worship places. He said one police officer was killed and several others sustained injuries while successfully preventing the bombers from entering the prayer halls and limiting the damage. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Venezuela's parliament gave President Nicolas Maduro new powers Sunday, enabling him to legislate by decree until the end of the year. He says parliament's action Sunday allows him to defend the country from threats from the United States. Mr. Maduro asked for the expanded powers after the U.S. placed sanctions on several Venezuelan officials accused of human rights violations. Police in the Midwest U.S. city of Ferguson, Missouri, have made an arrest in connection with last week's shooting of two police officers outside police headquarters. Both men were hospitalized and released. St. Louis prosecutor Robert McCulloch says 20-year-old Jeffrey Williams told authorities he was firing at someone with whom he was in a dispute, not at the police officers.
He has acknowledged his participation in firing the shots, or that in fact he did fire the shots that struck the two officers.
Williams is charged with two counts of first-degree assault, one count of firing a weapon from a vehicle, and three counts of armed criminal action. Hundreds of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets and cities across the country Sunday, demanding the ouster of the president, Dilma Rousseff, over government corruption. Much of the anger toward the president stems from revelations of a kickback scheme at state-run oil company Petrobras. At least $800 million was paid in bribes and other funds by the nation's biggest construction and engineering firms in exchange for inflated Petrobras contracts. Dozens of political figures are under investigation. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, March 16th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's Minister of Gender says women have made enormous progress under President Ellen Johnson-Sirleaf.
Prior to the 2005 elections, most women across the country were using the thumbprint to vote or to transact a business. After the elections, women in Liberia, almost 68% of them, read to some level.
Julia Duncan-Cassell is Liberia's Minister of Gender and Development. Some members of Swaziland's parliament decried judicial problems and want their prime minister to fix them or resign. And a South Sudan official says the country's civil war has nothing to do with who should own the disputed oil-rich Abyei territory.
What the government of South Sudan is saying is, yes, Abyei is a disputed area. And as long as the dispute is not resolved, none of us has the right to claim it.
Michael Makuei is South Sudan's information minister. A Zimbabwe court orders the country's security agencies to intensify their search of a missing pro-democracy activist. And an oil boom leads to a sharp increase in land disputes in Uganda. And positive messaging is helping transform Ethiopia's image. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's Minister of Gender and Development says the status of women has improved dramatically since President Ellen Johnson-Sirleaf came to power nearly 10 years ago. Julia Duncan-Cassell says most rural women who, prior to the 2005 election, could not read are now reading because of a literacy program introduced by the government. She also said market women are driving Liberia's informal economy and some of them are breadwinners. But Duncan-Cassell said Ebola has created a setback to the progress of Liberian women. She denied criticism that President Sirleaf, as Africa's first elected female president, has paid mostly lip service to women's issues such as rape of young women and stopping female genital mutilation.
When Madam Sirleaf took over, it was her ambition to empower women, and especially women from the rural women, the cross-border traders, the market women. Prior to the 2005 elections, most women across the country were using the thumbprint to vote or to transact a business. After the elections, women in Liberia, almost 68% of them, read to some level. They have literacy programs. They have savings and loan programs that they learn how to calculate from Liberian dollar to U.S. dollars. They have skills training through different programs throughout the country. The market women are almost the breadwinner. They drive the informal economy of our country. And like I always say, one of them said before Madam Sirleaf or before this Beijing platform, the women were at zero. And now they came from being zero to heroes. But Ebola, what it's done now, has taken them back to zero.
Now, since you mentioned Ebola, some say that Ebola orphans are not getting enough support from the government.
James, to some extent, once there's crisis in the country, everybody wants to be a player. But our work at the ministry is to ensure the rights of children are protected. Prior to Ebola, we had orphans. We had orphanages. But what Ebola has done, it has left us with what we have documented, 3,707 Ebola orphans. What we are doing as government is redocumenting these orphanages, making sure that they have the proper procedure in place that they can be able to help us care for these children. But as government and our partners, we have set up what's called the foster care program. And this is to train people within the community to serve as foster care parents. We also have what's called the safety net program through cash transfer for the orphans. Then we have next of kin, family members who can afford to, who are able to help take care of their late family member children. Then we have the boarding school program. I don't know if you know, James, but in Liberia, the violence against children is so high. Rape against children is so high.
President Sirleaf, when she came to power, she made cracking down on rape a top priority. Now, some people say, oh, that was just a lip service. So what is happening?
James, let me say this. The issue of violence against children is not a government thing. It's a societal thing. It's something that the society, the community should take ownership of. Parents have responsibility to their children. People should not allow their 10, 11-year-old child to be walking the street at midnight. But let me say what Madam Salif or this government has done since which she took power. The government acted the law, making rape a non-bidable crime. We established a special court for speedy trial of rape cases and GBV cases. You have these cases when it's documented, it goes to the process, the police, and it goes to court. But most time, it's the community, it's the family member that compromises the case because they don't want to go to court. They think that the process is too long when it could be on a farm or it could be doing something else. But the community itself, James, has a role to play. If we are to win this war against rape, it has to be done collectively.
Julia Duncan-Cassell is Liberia's Minister of Gender and Development. She was speaking with me from New York City, where she just attended the just-concluded UN conference on the status of women. South Sudan's information minister has reiterated that the contested territory of Abyei belongs to both Sudan and South Sudan. Michael Makui said the fate of Abyei should not be conditioned on ending the South Sudan civil war. He was reacting to news reports quoting Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir as saying that the contested Abyei region belongs to Sudan and will remain a Sudanese territory. President Bashir, who is seeking re-election for a third term in the coming April 13th election, reportedly made the comment while campaigning in West Kordofan State. But Minister Makui says the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement established that the people of Abyei will hold a referendum to determine if they want to be part of Sudan or South Sudan.
The statement of President Bashir is his opinion, but the agreements that are governing Abyei are very clear. The Abyei Protocol gives the people of Abyei the right to self-determination so that they determine their destiny. We are still waiting for the AU and the IGAD and the African Union and the UN to operationalize the provisions of the Abyei Protocol. That is to conduct a referendum in Abyei so that the people of Abyei determine their destiny.
This is kind of, a slap in the face of South Sudan. He's speaking to the youth in the Abyei region not to be deceived by taking up arms. And he's quoted as saying that, look at what is happening in South Sudan. They can't even take care of South Sudan. We do not want the destruction that happened in South Sudan to move here.
What is left in Abyei, they are the ones who did the destruction in Abyei. So there is actually nothing in Abyei to be rescued. What the government of South Sudan is saying is, yes, Abyei is a disputed area. And as long as the dispute is not resolved, none of us has the right to claim it.
Don't you think he's talking about the inability of both the rebels and the government in South Sudan to come to some peace agreement to end the war?
Bringing peace to South Sudan has nothing to do with Abyei. As the government of South Sudan, we are longing for that time when the people of Abyei will be given the right to determine their destiny. In lieu of that, the government of the South Sudan would actually prefer to put Abyei under a UN mandate, and the fate of Abyei cannot be anchored on peace in South Sudan.
Don't you think, Mr. Minister, he's talking about, you know, if you want to be a babysitter, if you want to establish a daycare center, you must know how to take care of one child before anybody can entrust you with two or three children.
This is absolutely wrong. South Sudan is not a babysitter. South Sudan is an independent institution with its sovereignty. Abyei is a disputed area between South Sudan and Sudan.
Do you think, Mr. Minister, that the prolonged peace process in South Sudan is also not making it possible for the Comprehensive Peace Agreement that will make Abyei have a referendum not to come into fruition?
The conflict in South Sudan has no connection in any way with the resolution of Abyei problem.
Michael Makui, South Sudan's Information Minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. Today's Monday, March 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 and a half minutes past the hour. A number of Swaziland members of parliament have asked Prime Minister Sibusiso Dlamini to fix the problems within the country's judicial system or step down. They complained about delay in criminal court cases and an impasse between the justice minister and his principal secretary. Prime Minister Dlamini has reportedly said he will not step down because the government is already working on solving those problems. Member of Parliament Jan Tsetole of the Swazi Democratic Party says no investor can want to do business in a country where the citizens have lost faith in their judicial system.
We are concerned as the voices of the people in Parliament about the state of the judiciary in the country. Because we had a debate on the budget of the Prime Minister, who also is head of government, we actually raised that the issue of judiciary is very key and primary and must be dealt with and corrected with immediate effect, and therefore called upon him to ensure that we have a judiciary that we can rely upon. And if he fails to do that, then he must resign from his position as head of government.
The Prime Minister has said that he's aware of the problems, but he doesn't necessarily have to resign to correct the problems.
Well, in Parliament, he said he is going to do something about the judiciary as asked, and therefore there will be no need for him to resign if the condition of our calling for his resignation was based on non-dealing with the judiciary issue.
What are the problems within the judiciary that you, the members of Parliament, are concerned about?
Well, it's the independence thereof and the matter it is run, that it no longer gives confidence to the citizens that it meets its mandate. Because when all else is gone and nowhere to hide, you have to be able to run to courts, and the courts must give that justice. But if we feel that the judiciary is so broken down that it doesn't deliver on that, then it speaks then to potentially affecting even new investments. If people can't trust the courts, they can't therefore trust the country with their investment.
Why are you concerned? What are some of the problems that make it that the people don't have confidence in the justice system?
Well, because there has been cases where you could see, even as a layperson, that there has been no proper scrutiny of justice or meeting out of justice in many scenarios where even the court officials, even the lawyers, the law society has at one stage marched or protested against the head of the judiciary, which is very unprecedented. So basically, we can no longer close our eyes and say nothing is wrong when even the officers of the court are not comfortable with the leadership of the judiciary.
Jan Tsetole is a member of the Swazi Democratic Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Mbabane. A Harare High Court judge on Friday ordered the police and the Central Intelligence Organization to intensify their search for missing pro-democracy activist Itai Zamara, who disappeared after staging sit-ins demanding President Robert Mugabe's resignation. Thomas Choripasi has more from Harare.
High Court Judge David Mangota ordered the authorities to intensify investigations into the alleged abduction of Itai Zamara, leader of the Occupy Africa Unity Square Pressure Group that is calling for President Robert Mugabe to step down for allegedly failing to run the country democratically and pushing Zimbabwe's economy into the abyss. One of Zamara's lawyers, Charles Kwaramba, confirmed the ruling that was made following an urgent application filed by the activist's wife, Shefra, yesterday.
The court then granted was an order that the respondents be directed to conduct searches for Zamara and to advertise on TV, in newspapers, on radio about the missing person. And also that they work hand in hand with lawyers and Zamara's relatives to search all possible places within the jurisdiction of the police to search until they find Zamara and to report once every 2 weeks to the High Court what their findings will be.
The attorney said the judge, however, refused to order a search of the country's intelligence holding cells and military bases, citing security reasons. This follows submissions by State Counsel Fortune Chimbaru that the state was not aware of Zamara's whereabouts and was equally concerned. A report filed with the police and court documents showed that Zamara was abducted by five unidentified men who were traveling in a white Isuzu vehicle.
state representatives came and, as expected, they denied any knowledge of the whereabouts of the missing person. So for that reason, the court could not make an order to the effect that the state must produce Tamara within 2 hours before a court. That order could not be granted.
Justice Mangota ordered the state to report back to the court every 2 weeks on the police's progress in the investigations. MDC founding president Morgan Tsvangirai is accusing Mr. Mugabe's administration of kidnapping Tsamara, a charge that ZANU-PF spokesperson Simon Kayamoyo has denied. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Ugandan police say there has been a sharp increase in land disputes, about 10 new cases being reported each day. The claims come amid an oil boom as investors appear to be cashing in by selling parcels of land to multiple buyers. Meanwhile, the people who have been living on the land for decades are chased away, sometimes with heavy hand. Sojino Ruzbla reports.
They say it came as a total surprise. The more than 1,000 people living in a makeshift camp called Ramutunga in the Hoima district in western Uganda say they have been kicked off their land without any warning because it has been earmarked for oil exploration. During early morning in late August of last year, the people woke up to the sounds of chaos and gunfire.
So what they are going ahead with gun and then burning house and then stealing our gold, and they come with the lorry, about vehicle, there are six like this. Everything which they are looting, some are they are burning houses, and then we are running away.
According to the police, 10 new cases of land disputes are reported daily, making it difficult to control the situation. But Ramutonga's case is slightly different, according to local government official Ambrose Mwensije. He says there are clear laws and regulating land ownership in Uganda, and that the people of Ramutonga do not have any proof that they either inherited or bought the land or were hosted by the owner. In his reading of the events, the people are used as proxies in a land dispute between what is to him the rightful owner and someone who is, quote, encroaching on the land. However, Ramutonga Helen Ayesiga disagrees. She says the government is not protecting them as it should.
We normally vote for the governing party, but they don't recognize us as Ugandans. We are here suffering. So my appeal is that the government should come and assist, because soon they will rush for votes, but they don't recognize us as Ugandans. Why do we even vote?
NAPE is a local grassroots community organization helping people in the oil-rich region of Hoima against exploitation. A few times a week, they host a local community radio show offering a platform to victims of land disputes and informing the people about their rights. According to NAPE field officer and radio host Vincent Nyengenya, the story of Ramutonga is not exceptional.
Major complaints about land grabbing. Once they learned that there is oil here, people from different parts of the country, from different parts of the world, have come here to Bunyoro to grab our land. Others have been conniving with other government officials to grab people's land.
A court judgment that will determine whether the people of Ramutonga can go back to what they call their homelands is set for March 23rd. One thing is sure, if the court rules against them, they will have to pack their belongings again and find a new home. Serginho Rosblatt for VOA News, Hoima.
Ethiopia was once known for its famine and droughts, but now headlines about the country are mostly positive, from its fast-growing economy to its emergence as a regional peacemaker. Martha van der Waal reports on how Ethiopia is changing the narrative.
Ethiopia is transforming rapidly. In the capital city, it's all about the construction of buildings and large infrastructural projects. And international headlines have also highlighted these changes. Not long ago, media reports about Ethiopia focused on war, poverty, famine, and drought. Now, the headlines focus more often on the East African nation's fast-growing economy. Foreign affairs spokesman Dina Mufti says the Ethiopian government actively contributed to changing its negative reputation.
It's a phenomenon that we have had once in the past. It is something that we have put behind us effectively. And everybody works to make sure that that agony won't recur, won't come back again.
And it's not only the double-digit GDP numbers of the past decade that attract positive headlines. Ethiopia's role as peace negotiator for regional conflicts such as South Sudan is boosting the country's diplomatic reputation as well. And the reputation of being a relatively stable country with an emerging economy and a growing middle class is reaping fruits, bringing back home Ethiopians from the diaspora. Henok Assefa is one of them running a consultancy firm. He says that foreign firms still need a bit of convincing to believe Ethiopia is also a place for business.
Investors that have never been to Ethiopia, it takes a while to convince them because their mindset in many ways is that this is a poor country where you go there to help people live a better life. They don't really see it as an opportunity so much.
But not everyone's lives are improving. The United Nations Development Program estimates that a third of Ethiopians still lives in poverty. And right groups frequently criticize the country's human rights record. Opposition parties, such as the Blue Party, accuse the government of violating basic democratic principles. Blue Party spokesman Jonathan Tesfai says Ethiopia's new and improved image is an illusion fabricated by the authorities.
The information comes from the statistical agency, and those guys are not to be trusted. And that's not only it, but the growth that we are having, the development or the bloom, whatever it is, it's only concentrated in Addis Ababa. If you go to the rural areas, they're lagging behind, and that's going to be very problematic in the future.
Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. South Africa beat Zambia 5-2 as Mali pimped Ghana 1-0 in Group A action at the Africa Under-20 Championships in Senegal on Sunday. Mali topped the group with 9 points. Ghana has 6, South Africa 3, while Zambia failed to score a point. Earlier on Saturday, Senegal pipped Republic of Congo 4-3 as Nigeria and Ivory Coast drew 2-2. Nigeria topped Group A with 7 points. Senegal has 4, Ivory Coast 3, and the Republic of Congo 1. Nigeria, Senegal, Mali, and Ghana progressed to the semifinals. They will represent Africa at the FIFA Under-20 World Cup later this year. Staying in Dakar, Senegal replaced the Democratic Republic of Congo as hosts of the African Under-23 Championships in December, the Confederation of African Football President Issa Hayatou told the media on Saturday. This follows his meeting with the Senegal head of state Macky Sall. No explanation was given for the change of venue for this tournament, which is the men's football qualifier for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Turning to athletics, Wilson Loyanale and Ethiopian Guteni Shona won the men's and women's contests respectively at the Seoul International Marathon in the South Korean capital Seoul on Sunday. Elsewhere, Ugandan Timothy Ayeko and Ethiopian Bitukan Fente Alemu triumphed in the men's and women's races at the IAAF cross-country permit meet in Antrim, Northern Ireland on Saturday, while Kenyan 800-meter Olympic champion and world record holder David Rudisha won his first two-lap race of the year in 1 minute and 45.01 seconds at the Sydney Track Classic in Australia on Saturday. Kenya's Magdalene Masai prevailed in the women's 5,000 meters. In volleyball, Tunisian defending champions Esperance beat Algeria's Bouraj Bouriridj in three straight sets at the quarterfinals in the Africa Men's Club Volleyball Championships in Sousse, Tunisia on Friday. Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel also dismissed Algeria's Setif 3-0. Egypt's Somoha beat Morocco's Ittihad Tangier 3-1, while in an all-Egyptian encounter, El Ahli edged their arch rivals Zamalek 3-2. This event is a World Men's Volleyball Club Championship qualifier. Finally, India beat Zimbabwe by 6 wickets at the Cricket World Cup in Auckland, New Zealand on Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, March 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Curtis Bynum, I'm James Button in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Next on Let's Talk. Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing the internet. This light-hearted show discusses topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, land reform. Despite the end of colonial rule and apartheid, vast amounts of land in Zimbabwe and South Africa and other regions on the continent are not being redistributed fairly and efficiently. We'll discuss this issue next time on VOA Africa.